again, we have to go back to how people form these beliefs. So we wouldn't say, oh, that person's irrational, or, oh, I can't even imagine someone thinking like that. If you can't imagine someone thinking differently than you, then you're not trying hard enough.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas, produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 14 of Damn the Absolute. Coming to some semblance of consensus opinion is a paramount challenge in a pluralistic world. We disagree on what constitutes truth and how we ought to obtain it, whether our undertaking be moral, scientific, or political. It has been a common practice in Western philosophy to focus on uncovering an accurate reflection of reality, in hopes that by showing others these true representations of the world, we can bring our community members into agreement. This view holds that if we can clearly present objective truth, we can create meaningful consensus en route to fostering a more peaceful and thriving existence for humanity. In reality, people disagree, oftentimes vehemently and even violently, on what counts as evidence and which methods for discovering truth are most convincing. We pit our chosen experts against one another. Your preferred philosopher or politician may persuade you and your circle of friends, but what do we do when others are unmoved by what seems to us to be so obviously true? Justin Marshall is a pragmatist philosopher with a graduate degree from George Mason University. He argues that better understanding how our beliefs are formed can help us to navigate the ways in which truth and divergent viewpoints continually perplex liberal democracies and pluralistic societies. Drawing inspiration from thinkers like William James, Charles Sanders Peirce, and Richard Rorty, he explains the roles personal temperament, experiences, language, and culture play in shaping truth. He challenges us to practice more intellectual humility and to reconsider the idea that we can know whether our ideas actually hook up to reality in any meaningful or certain way. Now, to what degree are our beliefs reflections of our temperaments rather than reflections of objective reality? How might it benefit us to view language as a tool for helping us to better cope with reality, rather than as a one-to-one representation of the world? If our notions of truth are contingent upon our particular cultures, personal histories, or demographic backgrounds, how do we avoid the trap of philosophical relativism? And what social and political solutions can philosophical pragmatism offer us in a pluralistic world? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me.
In a spirit of welcoming you, what is a viewpoint you've held as an adult you were confident wouldn't change has actually shifted dramatically for you?
Hopefully this isn't too meta, but I think just the idea that changing your mind is a virtue and not a vice. I used to think the goal of intellectual life was to kind of find certainty about foundational principles and prove that they're true, which I, as an open-minded person, always had some issue with intuitively. But I guess when I started reading the pragmatists is when they really encouraged that evolution of thought, saw it as something positive, which really struck with me.
Justin, you mentioned the pragmatist philosophers as a group of thinkers who have had a profound impact on your intellectual journey. Charles Sanders Peirce, among them, has an essay, The Fixation of Belief, which has informed some of your worldview. What is at the heart of that essay?
So the core of that essay is talking about how people's personalities affect what they believe, much like William James also talks about. And this is where Peirce first sets out the scientific mindset, as he calls it, compared to other mindsets, which he would say are based on fixing opinions by appeals to either authority or tradition. And he very much advocates for an empirical approach where the only thing that we can learn from is our experience, and that if there are beliefs that are held due to authority and tradition, but don't line up with experience, that those can be discarded, essentially.
Are there specific examples that Peirce brings up in that essay?
Well, he talks a lot about the experience of people who encounter other people with different worldviews than their own. And I think this is especially relevant in the increasingly diverse and pluralistic world that we live in. He talks about this really important experience in people's lives where perhaps for the first time they meet people with beliefs very opposed to what they believe, but the person is intelligent, well-intended, well-informed, and that experience can cause a bit of a crisis in people to say, wow, maybe the beliefs that I hold aren't necessarily a reflection of the correct way to view the world, but maybe a result of how I was raised and my upbringing and my education. And you know, having that experience where you interact with people that you find just as smart as you, just as kind as you, but believe diametrically opposing things to you, it starts to raise a lot of these questions about how are our beliefs actually formed.
You mentioned William James as well on this connection between temperament and philosophical worldviews. And James and Peirce were good friends. They were both a part of the Metaphysical Club. Could you elaborate a bit more on what James meant by this connection between temperament and philosophical worldviews?
Yeah, so James talks about the temperament of professional philosophers, theologians, intellectuals in general, and talks about how it's actually their personality or their temperament, as he calls it, that determines their philosophy, which sort of turns things on its head for the traditional Western thought of we're trying to find true beliefs and demonstrate that they're true. He's saying, no, a lot of our beliefs and opinions are really just reflections of our personalities. And he talks about tender-minded people versus tough-minded people. Tender-minded people are more rationalistic, more religious, tend to stress free will more. Tough-minded people are more empiricists, materialists, tend to be less religious and pluralistic. And obviously, we can see how different worldviews might fit into one of those two categories. But the interesting thing about James is that he's saying that it's almost an unconscious belief that we hold whether we fall into either of those two camps. He also talks about how people tend to have beliefs on more of a subconscious. So he also talks about how beliefs tend to be more of an unconscious reaction to our environment than we think they are. We like to think that our beliefs are very well thought out and that we've come to them through reason, rationality. But the way James describes it is people tend to react and then we retroactively try to justify our belief by giving these more objective reasons, which again is quite contrary to the way since Plato we've thought about seeking truth, where we try to seek out true beliefs and opinions. James is saying we more or less just have them unconsciously, and then we haphazardly try to justify ourselves.
It brings to mind for me, and I believe this is a Rumi quote, of we see the world not as it is, but as we are. And I really appreciate that insight. In hand with this pluralistic approach you embrace is this skepticism toward the notion of objective truth, which you've been talking about. Why do you find the concept of objective truth so problematic?
Well, I guess there's a few reasons that the pragmatists talk about. One is what we've just touched on, where we're not really using objective methods to determine truth. We're oftentimes just subconsciously forming these beliefs and opinions and then retroactively justifying them. So that obviously seems like a different process than discovering truth. And then the other would, I guess, be how pragmatists think about language, whereas a lot of people think that sentences are either true or false based on if they reflect reality. Pragmatists doesn't believe that. We don't believe that language corresponds to reality in some one-to-one way, as philosophy is often taught, and how I also believe is sort of the common sense approach of a lot of people, at least in America.
So as an example here, Justin, if I were to say, I believe in God or I believe God exists, how might a pragmatist unpack that versus somebody else?
Well, obviously, when we're talking about more easily observable things that everyone can agree on, that's still not correspondence, but it's a bit closer. So if there's a rock and it's hard and everybody can knock on the rock and see that it's hard, we can all agree on that, more or less. But as we start to get into moral topics, political topics, religious topics, we're just in a totally different realm, a realm of values, where we could all be presented with the same facts about the world or experience, still have totally different beliefs about God or free will, metaphysical questions. And there's really nothing in experience to help us decide which to pick. So while interestingly enough, James and Peirce both have talked about some kind of mystic religious experiences, they're very much against doing metaphysics or theology. They just don't think we have the perspective from which to make any sense of those questions. So when we're talking about God, for example, I don't think a pragmatist would say that God doesn't exist. They would just say that they don't even know what it would clearly mean to claim that God did exist.
How might either James or Peirce go about evaluating someone's claims or beliefs in the realm of religion then?
I don't think they would, but at the same time, pragmatism has to apply its own critiques to itself and be pluralistic and say that it's not our place to judge the validity of someone else's personal experience. So if someone says they've had a personal experience that led them to a certain theological belief, I don't think we really have anything that we could say to them that would dissuade them. And I think that that's one difference between the classical pragmatists and maybe some of the more contemporary pragmatists, where James, and I think particularly Peirce, was very optimistic about the appeal of pragmatism and maybe thought it would take off or become the dominant worldview at some point. Whereas I think contemporary pragmatists are maybe a little bit more skeptical about that. And back to James saying that there are some of us whose personalities or temperaments are already, that some people's personalities and temperaments already have a predisposition to be attracted to pragmatism, and some people wouldn't.
If someone were to talk about religious experience as a means of, for them, confirming or justifying a view they have, let's use an example, more hot button issue. Let's say that my religious experience informs my view that homosexuality is either a sin or immoral or wrong. How might the rest of us in conversation, or how might everyone else in conversation with me, if I'm talking with a bunch of pragmatists, agree or dissuade me from that view?
I think that they would, instead of referring to first principles or ultimate theological beliefs or divinely inspired moral laws or something like that, I think that they would talk more about the consequences of, in this case, homosexuality, and talk about different people's experiences, what the results of that are. I think what a pragmatist would do is try to demonstrate to the person that their belief about homosexuality being right or wrong isn't a matter of them having discovered any moral truth about the universe. It's more of a result of their upbringing, everything that they've been taught. So when I talk to people about issues like homosexuality, or recently I've had a few talks about the trans debate with people, instead of going right into arguments, I usually start by asking them, how many gay friends do you have? Or do you have experience with trans people? And typically the people that have the most strong moral objections to it don't have that experience, which I find interesting. And I think that just goes back to Peirce talking about pluralism. A lot of people live in communities where they interact mostly with people who think like themselves, and it's easy to sort of get in a confirmation bias bubble there. But when you're confronted with people that you like, that live different lifestyles than you or have different beliefs than you, I think that's what changes people's minds on these moral issues versus some more rationalistic argument that you're going to make with them.
You're talking a lot about the pluralism at pragmatism, and you're also resisting this notion of first principles, especially in discussion with others. What are some of the guiding principles of pragmatism, or does pragmatism even have a foundation or an inherent nature?
So pragmatism doesn't have first principles in the sense of things that are unquestionable assumptions that we have to start our inquiry from. However, they do have guiding principles, but those are always open to change, and they are based on observations that hopefully everyone can agree upon, free from actual doubt, as Peirce would say. So things like human beings are habit-forming creatures in relationship with their environments, or James saying that oftentimes people's beliefs are a reflection of their personalities or temperament. Pragmatism makes all these observations about how we live and how we form beliefs, and then sees what results from there. And I think that's a very different project than starting from first principles, because instead of trusting first principles, we're just trusting a method, and we don't know where it's going to lead. And so it's sort of like philosophizing without a net. We're just following experience wherever it leads us, even though we don't know what opinions and beliefs that's going to result in.
So as you're describing pragmatism as having guiding principles but resisting first principles, would it be more accurate to describe pragmatism as an attitude toward life or an attitude toward philosophy?
Absolutely. I think that's even a better way to describe it than to try to describe it by a coherent group of beliefs, because pragmatists don't agree on things, and pragmatism itself is a pluralistic community where people are disagreeing all the time. And I see that as a strength as opposed to a fault.
At a glance, pragmatists are intensely empirical in their approach to science and truth, as you've been talking about, which might cause someone to think that pragmatists are a more common or run-of-the-mill scientists. In what ways do pragmatist scientists approach science differently than others?
So I think a good way to explain this is to talk about a view of science and history, logical positivism, which is the idea that the goal of science is to sort of come up with these materialistic descriptions of how the world is, and at some point we're going to have this complete picture of the way things are. Pragmatists are empiricists, and they think that all knowledge comes from experience, and that we should do our best to form our opinions by experiences that are available publicly that we can demonstrate to other people. But they're also a bit postmodern, I guess you could call it, in the sense that we don't think that our even scientific statements are objective reflections of reality. As Richard Rorty would say, we have no way of knowing when language stops being our own, stops being ours, and is nature's own language. So yes, we use empiricism, we use methods akin to science, but the goal is still not to find objective truths. And I think a good example of this in science would be Thomas Kuhn, who talks a lot about paradigm shifts. I think he might have coined that term, where we have beliefs and we have biases from those beliefs, even in our scientific experiments. So maybe an anomaly will come up and we'll kind of discard it or ignore it. And then at some point, anomalies add up enough where we have a paradigm shift in science where we have to start using different concepts in different words. So changing our concepts, changing our words, finding new and better ways to describe things is a good thing to a pragmatist, but also very different than finding some eternal absolute truth about the way the world is.
Are there examples in how a pragmatist might study emotions or neuroscience differently than a different type of empiricist would study them?
I think so. And there's been a lot of interesting work in pragmatism and neuroscience. And I think it just questions some of the basic assumptions about neuroscience because of how we're talking about language. I think sometimes we mistake our concepts for actual things in the universe. So a neuroscientist might say, you know, what is the neuroscience of anger? So what we get people angry, I guess, and then brain scan them and study which things light up in their brain. But I don't think that would be a very interesting experiment for a pragmatist, because different people can mean different things by anger. And even if we see that anger more times than not lights up a certain area of the brain, I'm not sure exactly what use that would be to know.
Yeah, there's some philosophers who work in this area who will resist that notion of reducing anger to just what's happening in the brain. A neuroscientist may approach it and take a brain scan and go, oh, see, these areas light up. That's what anger is, and that's the most concrete and real. Whereas a pragmatist, as I understand, may look at that and say, those may be happening when someone's angry, but we can't just reduce anger to this thing we scan.
Totally, yeah. And that's another thing that maybe separates pragmatists from a lot of traditional scientists is that we don't believe that a lot of things in experience can be reduced down to scientific descriptions or any descriptions using language for that matter. So also a lot of people tend to think of emotions, things like anger, being somehow inside, internal in your brain, a brain state, I guess is what philosophers would call it. But especially as pragmatism moves along, it gets further out from the brain. Peirce, for example, talks about doubt as if it is more or less an internal feeling. And Dewey extends that even further out to say doubt is like an indeterminate situation or circumstance. So I think that a pragmatist would take emotions and not be that interested in studying them as some type of internal state, but studying them in the context of the environments in which they arise.
Going back to this brain scan idea, if I were to have someone write a piece of literature or a short story and record their brain while recording that short story, and I could look at the brain scans, I don't think there's anybody who could look at a brain scan and then come away with the same conclusion of what that short story actually contained. And I think that seems like a pragmatist view as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, because we just can't reduce complex phenomena to simple scientific descriptions. And that kind of refers back to not a pragmatist, but a famous philosopher that a lot of people have to read in school, Thomas Nagel. And his famous paper is What It's Like to Be a Bat. And his conclusion is, even if we were to know every possible physical description of bats, we would still have no idea what it was like to be a bat. And I think that's a good way to explain kind of the anti-reductionism of pragmatism.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Pragmatists are generally not very interested in what could be considered representations of the world. And this goes back to the view that objective truth is a confused concept. What do pragmatists mean when they say that they reject the correspondence theory of truth?
So a pragmatist sees language less as a medium in which we try to form accurate pictures of reality and more as a part of behavior of human beings. So on this view, the activity of saying sentences is one of coping with our environment versus trying to create accurate representations of our environment. Rorty even talks about there not being any meaningful distinction between the writing styles of science and literature. They're both doing the same thing, which I think is pretty radical, but makes a lot of sense. So I think a pragmatist would say that we have no way of verifying if our sentences do correspond to reality. And this goes back to Kant saying that there is no thing in and of itself that we have access to study or describe. We only know things through the lens of our language, vocabularies, culture, etc. So we have no perspective from which to get outside of our language and our culture to see if our language lines up with the way reality really is, quote unquote. And again, as Rorty would say, the world doesn't speak, only we do. And we would have no way of knowing when our language ceased being our words and started to reflect nature's own language, whatever that would mean.
So if we're in a conversation, a group of us, and I'm putting forward language that I use to help me cope with my political environment, you're doing the same. Everyone in the group is doing the same. And we come to different political views around, say, Joe Biden's recent infrastructure plan. How might we go about navigating coming to agreement?
Well, I think that a lot of the confusion in political discussion happens with people defining terms differently. So pragmatism gives a lot of importance to trying to, in this circumstance that you're describing, at least trying to understand the vocabularies of others and help them better understand yours. So I think that's first. A lot of times people, especially in political conversations, are sort of talking past each other instead of to each other because they're using words in different ways. So in the pragmatism's view of pluralism, I think our goal is to understand how other people are using vocabularies, and that immediately makes us more sympathetic to where they're coming from. I think that someone like Peirce might have been a little bit too optimistic, hoping that maybe someday we would all have the same vocabulary, and then we could really get to some agreements on things. But in the pluralistic world that we live in, that doesn't seem realistic. So I think the best we can do is try to understand how other people are using words. Back to the, we talked a little bit about gender debates. Like, a lot of that is just because people define gender differently, or they define sex differently, and they're using these words in different ways. So of course they're not going to come to agreement. But if we explain to each other how we're using our words, we might not come to agreement, but at least we can come to a civil point where we agree to disagree and we understand what the other person's saying. And a lot of times I think that's almost just as helpful as coming to agreement.
You mentioned Peirce and his view of being a bit optimistic that we would come to converge on a common view of truth. Could you speak a bit more about Charles Peirce's view on truth and the community of inquirers and what that means?
Yeah, so Peirce thinks that truth, the best way of settling opinions is by appealing to experience that is common to everyone. So optimistically, I guess he would say, like, I think he says that truth basically is, he doesn't really ever describe like objective truth, but the closest he would get is to say truth would be whatever the entire community of inquirers eventually settles upon. I don't think that that's likely, but I understand where he's coming from.
And that arriving or settling at a position as a community, is that something that is ever realized, or is that an idealized goal?
I think it's an idealized goal. I mean, it obviously happens within smaller communities, but as soon as we are interacting with people who believe differently than us, have different backgrounds than us in our pluralistic societies, I don't think that that's really the goal. Maybe the goal in public life, where we can agree to leave our metaphysical, theological, moral, religious arguments kind of out of the sphere of politics, and then we can maybe just talk about actual experiences people are having, consequences of policies, things like that. And maybe we'd be able to get to some larger consensus. But I think that within particular communities, it's possible. But as to have a society as diverse as the United States, for example, ever have, you know, the majority of people coming to the same conclusions about moral, political, religious things, I just don't think that that's likely. So it's almost just like a thought experiment, I think, to Peirce, to say that the truth that in the end, you know, at some future point, if everyone came into agreement, that would be the truth. But I think what's interesting about that is not what the content of that final truth would be, but the idea that it's the consensus of the community that forms truth, not the other way around. And I think that a lot of people find that point in pragmatism particularly disturbing, that consensus is what forms truth versus truth forming consensus, which is consistent throughout all the pragmatists, but people tend to find pretty problematic.
Yeah, it seems problematic in the sense of, one way it seems problematic is some of us, when we present a well-reasoned argument, or what we think is a well-reasoned argument, we're trying to use that to then basically force everyone else, where we can hold it up and say, here is truth, or here is logic, and you need to abide by it. Otherwise, you're unreasonable, or you're outside of the community, etc.
Totally. And Rorty talks a lot about this, about how to deal with people that we disagree with. And he thinks that thinking of them as less rational than us, or God forbid, evil or something like that, is is totally unhelpful. Again, we have to go back to how people form these beliefs. So we wouldn't say, oh, that person's irrational, or, oh, I can't even imagine someone thinking like that. If you can't imagine someone thinking differently than you, then you're not trying hard enough to imagine. People's differences in political, moral, religious debates have less to do with how rational they are and more to do with their lifestyles, how they were brought up, who they're surrounded with, what books they read, what movies they've seen, etc. And Robert Talese, I think, a pragmatist at Vanderbilt, wrote a book about this last year, sort of a social psychology of political beliefs. And he says if you basically figure out if somebody goes to Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts, or whether they shop at Walmart or Target, or whether they carry a backpack or a tote bag, and a few other things, you can pretty much predict how they're going to vote or how they're going to feel on certain moral and political issues. So pragmatism is very much sort of like, I think it predates social psychology, but it's very much a social psychology of our belief, which I think a lot of people find intimidating, because if our beliefs are just the result of everything that happened to us, contingency of belief, as Rorty would call it, then what's the use? We're all just, we don't know anything. We're just accidental results of our lives. And people find that very problematic, but it's also a pretty hard notion to argue against.
The classical pragmatists, like Peirce and James, really focus on experience. And you've talked about this a little bit, but you have neo-pragmatists like Richard Rorty, who supplant the emphasis of experience with that on language. What can you say a little bit more about what this linguistic turn in philosophy looks like and where it's led pragmatism?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of an overhyped debate, the controversy between experience or language, or some pragmatists saying that Rorty is a neo-pragmatist, has supplanted experience with language. I think Rorty would say that language is an experience that we have. So I think that those two things can live in harmony, but the linguistic turn that we're talking about can still be totally empirical, but it's what we've mentioned, just the non-correspondence of truth, where our goal is no longer to come up with absolutely correct descriptions of reality. Maybe in physics or chemistry, we can come up with more stable truths that more people believe and have more consensus. But as soon as we get into realms of morals, politics, religion, things like that, finding some type of certainty just isn't our goal. And I think that that is one of the most powerful conclusions of pragmatism that, again, a lot of people find contrary to common sense or find problematic, that finding true descriptions of reality isn't really our goal. And whereas that has been the goal for a lot of Western philosophy in history, it really flips that on its head. I guess I can't understate how much pragmatism is critical of a lot of the tradition and a very different method of thinking about the world than, say, a metaphysician or a theologian.
I want to turn some criticism toward pragmatism. In what ways do you think pragmatism falls short? Or rather, what are areas in your philosophical worldview where you feel the most unsettled?
So where I think pragmatism goes wrong a bit is, as I've touched on a little bit, in our assumption that we have the most useful worldview and that it's our job to spread that to people, and perhaps some misplaced optimism that pragmatism is best suited in the end for most people. I think that that's not sufficiently criticizing ourselves in the way that we criticize others, in the sense that I don't subscribe to pragmatism because I found it to be the true description of reality. I subscribe to pragmatism because it's the worldview that is most aligned with my personality and my own temperament. So I think pragmatists need to be a little bit more humble about the value of pragmatism. John Stuart calls it a season of belief, pragmatism, where it works for some people in our society now. And maybe Peirce is right. Maybe the more people interact with people different than them because of diversity, because of interconnectedness with communications, whatever, that maybe more people will arise in a society that will be drawn to pragmatism, or society will create more people with a personality conducive to pragmatism. But I'm not sure that's the case. And so I think the pragmatists need to sometimes be a little bit more humble about how they form their own beliefs, and remember that pluralism is the goal, not for everyone to become a pragmatist necessarily.
I want to lob, Justin, one last thing. And you've already mentioned a few social and political issues, but what are a couple ones that you think a lot on that you think pragmatism can help resolve or dissolve even?
I think that in politics, people oftentimes mistake words for distinct movements or distinct groups of people. And I think that we generalize and stereotype each other far too much. And I think that pragmatism could help with that. Whereas, say, we have arguments between socialism or capitalism, for example, those aren't coherent ideas that everyone agrees on the definitions that live out there in reality that are fighting against each other, where one is right and one are wrong and one is wrong. People are very, very diverse and don't typically fall into these simple pre-prescribed buckets. So I think pragmatism reminds us to let's get away from these really theoretical, pie in the sky arguments of which abstract principle or school of thought is right and which one is wrong. We can talk about what are the consequences of specific policies, or what ideas do you have to deal with this certain public program, without having to choose a team and say, I'm a capitalist, I'm a socialist, I'm a right winger, I'm a left winger. I think that pragmatism would encourage people to interact more with people who disagree with them, try to figure out what their vocabularies are so that we can have at least the hope of some coherent conversation versus just speaking past each other. And then the goal isn't necessarily to agree with each other. Like I said, I don't think that that's ever going to happen on most of these moral issues. But even understanding each other better and understanding where we agree to disagree, I think is huge, and can lead people to a place where they're respectful of people's opinions, even if they are very different from them, and stop thinking of those people as irrational, totally uninformed, evil, whatever. They're just people with different backgrounds that have come to different opinions and beliefs than us, and that's okay. But I think the more we understand how beliefs form, the more tolerant we are of other people who disagree with us, and the more humble we are about our own beliefs, which I think is a helpful attitude for a pluralistic democratic society.
Justin, thank you for coming on the show, getting a little bit muddy amongst the different pragmatisms, and hopefully we can be a little bit more tolerant and pluralistic as a society.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jeffrey. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.